Hello, everyone, and welcome to Grad Chat by PhD Balance, where we talk about topics of grad school beyond academic research and that may be a bit more difficult to talk about in our day-to-day. I'm your host, Linda Corcoran, and I'm currently completing my research master's in food science. And for PhD Balance, I'm the Grad Chat lead and a Twitter coordinator. If you missed it, we are now pre-recording episodes before release. All episodes are still available via video on the PhD Balance YouTube channel and via audio on all major streaming platforms. So don't forget to subscribe on your chosen platform to get notifications about new episodes. Our topic today is going to grad school after working, and I'm really excited to welcome our guest, Courtney Applewhite. Courtney is a PhD candidate in religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, studying death. When she's not volunteering for Grad Chat, you can find her trial running, lifting weights, and spending time with her cats. Welcome, Courtney. We're so pleased to have you on Grad Chat to discuss your experiences.
I'm really excited to be here, Linda. Thanks for having me.
So I guess this is your first introduction to everyone. Courtney has just joined the Grad Chat team. She's helping out with us. You have a load of experiences that you are sharing with us today. So why don't we start, do you want to start with work before grad school, or do you want to start with grad school and what you're doing? Because you're doing an interesting topic.
Yeah, no, they kind of go hand in hand. I can tell you a little bit about what I'm doing now, though. So I'm a PhD candidate, and I'm in religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And specifically, I work on death, and I work on death ritual. And that's typically in the contemporary United States is my area of focus. And my dissertation topic is about innovative death practices. And particularly, I'm looking at the way in which bodies are disposed of. So if you think about things like burial and cremation, like alternatives and innovations in that realm. And so I'm working on my dissertation research now, but that research comes from like a long history of being involved in death work. So when I graduated from college, my undergrad degree was a double degree in religious studies and cognitive sciences. And I had no idea what I wanted to do out of college. I ended up going to work for a publishing company, and they worked on children's books. And I was in Texas at the time, so it was like Texas children's books, and it was sort of like a random job that I got. But I, you know, enjoyed writing and I enjoyed editing, so I did that work. But I rapidly determined that the publishing industry wasn't for me, and I'd been watching a lot of Bones, that TV show Bones, and I got really into forensics, and I was like, oh, I want to do a job like this. And so I Googled forensic jobs in Houston, which is where I lived at the time. And it turns out that the medical examiner's office or the coroner's office was hiring entry-level death investigators. And so here I was like a year and a half out of college, and I was interviewing. I've never really been involved in death work, but I was ready to be Bones. So I went to the interview and they were like, we need people. So you seem like you're a competent person. We can hire you to do this. It'd be great. And so I worked in that job for several years. I was a death investigator at the medical examiner's office. And so my job was to go to scenes of death. And this was typically non-natural deaths. So scenes of homicide, of suicide, of accidents, of undetermined deaths, to help the coroner or the medical examiner determine the cause of death. So I was the scene investigator part, and then we would bring the person back to the medical examiner's office for their autopsy to determine the cause and manner of death. So that was my role. And so I worked in this capacity for several years, and I knew that I didn't want to do, so this is an entry-level position, and I know a lot of really seasoned death investigators who are, you know, brilliant, and they do wonderful work, and death work is so hard. But for me, I wanted to do work that was a little bit more research and orientation, and I wanted to do additional study in this kind of field. And so I considered a lot of different options. I thought about going full-blown medical school. I was one of those people that was like pre-med in college, but then rapidly decided I didn't want to do that. And then I reconsidered it. I was like, maybe I just want to go be a forensic pathologist who do the autopsies. And so I thought that route. I thought about going the forensic psychology or not forensic psychology route is another one that I thought about, like, you know, doing the competency to stand trial. I thought about doing the forensic anthropology, which is the actual bone stuff. And there was a few people that I worked with that had done masters in that. So thinking about grad school, but I had this background in religious studies, and one of the challenges that I saw, because a lot of my job was to interact with families. So I usually talk to, when I talk to people about this work, I'm like, you know, working with the dead is really easy, but it's the living that are the hardest part to work with. You know, that's the challenging part. And these families often were conflicted in the sense that they didn't know what to do next. There was a disconnect. And what do we do, especially in these cases of sudden or unexpected death? Often the people were young. They weren't necessarily like in a position where they were likely going to die. So it was a lot of confusion. And so I turned back to my background in religious studies. And I was like, how can I start thinking about this? The people that I was most interested in when I did my religious studies degree were people who described as spiritual, but not religious. So ironically, now I'm housed in the religious studies department, but I actually study non-religious or unaffiliated people and how they deal and cope with and enact rituals around death without the structure of religion. And so all of that work in the field and interacting with these families sort of informed my decision to go to grad school and study these types of people and their interactions with death. And so all of it kind of culminated in what I do now.
That is a really unique path. I guess my first question is, you obviously said that you had a ton of pathways that you could have gone. So how did you make that decision about which way you were going to go? Did you talk to people? Did you do research? I know informational interviews are sometimes very popular. So where did you start?
Yeah, totally. And I think this is a really important thing for undergrads. I mentor undergrads and I talk to them about informational interviewing and things all the time. So the first thing that I did is that first job that I had that was in publishing, I got an internship in my senior year of college at this really small publishing house. And that's how I kind of, because I love books, I love reading. And so that seemed, in general, I think my advice would be to follow your interests and follow your passions and then reach out to people that are in that network. So for example, I was on LinkedIn. I saw that this small publishing house existed. I saw the person who owned it. And it happened to be that I was going to school with her goddaughter or something like that. And I knew her through like another connection. So I reached out to her goddaughter, who then connected me with her. And that's how I got that position. And then again, in this thread of following your interests, I know it sounds silly, but I was really into Bones. Like I binge watched Bones. I loved Criminal Minds. I love like all of these sort of the true crime stuff, so into it. And so, I mean, not everyone should do this, but I in particular was like, I think I want to try this. Like, and I was in the position where I could, you know, reach out to people. And then I just gave it a shot. It's sort of like, you got to shoot your shot, right? I think you read these statistics all the time of particularly women not believing they're qualified for a job. Well, if I was ever not qualified for a job, it was the one I got at the medical examiner's office. To be frank, like, and this is, you know, just to be aware, I'm going to be talking about death and context of death a lot in this interview. I had seen a dead body, like maybe twice at wakes, like, you know, at funerals. And at the first day that they interviewed me, they walked me through the morgue because they were like, you have to be able to, and I didn't know how I was going to react in that situation. And you don't, but you have to follow your interests and then just take chances on yourself and take chances on the opportunities that you have. And so that just so happened that I Googled it and they were hiring and I just took a shot at it. I was like, I'm going to have to go in there pretty honest. Like, I'm not perfect for this position. I don't have a lot of background, but I'm a fast learner. I'm willing to do the work. I'm a good communicator. So these are the things that you kind of have to turn to. And the same thing happened with grad school. Like, and that's the same process you go through with grad school. I followed my interest. I followed my intuition about what I was interested in. And then I emailed a lot of different advisors and I was like, this is what I want to do. Here's my background experience. I'm not a traditional academic in the sense that I'm fresh out of undergrad. I am coming from a very practical place and I want to use this practical knowledge to inform my study. Like I want to do a really practical dissertation, which is not always a super welcome concept in the humanities. We're very like sometimes oriented towards theory and things like that, but I wanted to do a really grounded practical thing. And I was really upfront. And again, it's just following your interests and following what you want for yourself and what you want out of your work. And I kind of tried to do that at every stage. And, you know, I'm at the dissertation stage, we have to start thinking about jobs, right? And that's the next step. And I'm trying to embody that in this next step too, about where my interests are and what I want to do next.
Yes. So that is that is a great way to go about it, I think. Always with whenever you can bring in your interests, it's great. Right. And I also love all of those shows as well. And I'm like,
I know. They're great.
Yeah. I'm like, but unlike you, I've never thought I'm going to make this a job, but that's why I'm in food and not religion.
We all have our things. I don't watch Top Chef and think that's what I'm going to do for a job. So,
I guess how you mentioned you talk to advisors and everything like that. I know the humanities can work a little differently. Sometimes when we're talking about PhDs and grad school, we often talk about STEM. So how do humanities PhDs work, or how do they work for you anyway?
Yeah, I think this is important because I do think a lot of the conversation does tend to be around STEM and finding labs and lab shopping and sort of these sorts of things that you tend to do. So in the humanities, I'm going to speak broadly, but I want to just caveat, of course, that each sort of discipline is going to be a little bit different, and each area of the world is going to be a little different. But typically speaking, in the humanities, you aren't doing the thing that you do in STEM, which is where you get into a lab and then you tend to work on a project that your PI is sort of like an offshoot of your PI's project, or like a like some sort of affiliative project. In the humanities, you're really more looking for somebody who has a more ethereal connection to your project. It's like an area of interest that you're interested in, or an area, or a period of time, or like a particular method that is going to be how you're going to conduct your dissertation research. And they're more of a person who is there to advise and support you, but you're not typically working on their project, because in the humanities, we're very much still in the mindset of like single authorship, monographs as opposed to articles. And so as a result, you aren't going to be like working on their project, because that's going to be their monograph, that's going to be their next book. So you're really doing something that's somehow tangentially related to it. Like, for example, my advisor works on experience and religious experience, and I wanted to work with her because I thought it was going to be important, the embodiment of like death and dying, I thought was going to be really important to my project, the fact that it is an experiential thing of grief. And so that was one of the reasons I was really wanting to work with her. And so again, like, she works on a lot of different things. She works on hearing like revealed texts and things like that. Like, she does stuff on Mormonism and things like that. And so I don't work on any of that, but I do. And she also works on North American traditions, which is my area of study. And then I have another. So typically in the humanities, you know, you form a dissertation committee, and that's true of all PhD disciplines. And so, and then the rest of your committee kind of rounds out your focus area. So I have another committee member who isn't my direct advisor, but like really does provide a lot of support, who is methodologically similar to me. He does ethnography, and he also studies non-religious people. So there's both a content and a method overlap. And then my third point person does North American religious history, which is not, I don't do the historical part, but it's important for me to have that in my wheelhouse if I want to be competitive on the job market. So whenever you're searching for people to work with through the humanities, you are looking for an advisor that sort of, again, it's not necessarily a project. I mean, if you're interested in their project, that's a perfect starting place. If you Google, like, you know, if you're interested in 4th century Tibetan Buddhism or something like that, and you Google that, the scholar that's working on that is probably a good person to go to have it as an advisor. But it's much more of like a courtship. Like, you sort of email them, you're like, I'm interested in working with you, and they're just like, here's my areas of interest and what I'm thinking about. And they're like, well, I am accepting students at this time, so let's have a conversation about this. So it's a little bit more of a, it's not really you get into the school, it's almost like you get in with the advisor, because they're often on the other side of that admission committee table saying, no, I'm going to work with that person, we've talked about it, I feel really confident bringing them on, that kind of thing. So you're applying to the school, but you're also applying to work with that particular advisor. And a lot of the time on applications for humanities departments, they'll actually ask you to name who you're planning to work with. And if that person knows your name and knows who you are and knows your project, then you're much more likely to be competitive in an application.
That makes sense. And it's a bit more how things work in Europe, obviously, where I am, but that's kind of across the board. Mm. If it's, we don't really do general applications, it's you find someone to work with and hopefully they have money and either they have a project that maybe you're interested in, or they will help you find money, or they'll say they're not interested.
Right, right. Courtship. It's always a courtship. Your dowry.
The big important thing, the money.
I know.
Always ask about money for anyone looking. Always ask about
money. Always ask about money, particularly in the humanities, because that's even less of like the professor is on a grant. Like I'm pretty lucky. I am working on a grant with a professor at this point. So I'm a research assistant on a grant. It's pretty rare in the humanities though. So usually you're looking at fellowships that are sponsored by the university or departmental money. And it's critical to ask about money first, y'all. Critical.
Definitely. It's not rude. Always ask about money. Do not self-fund.
Well, and actually, I'll
unless pivot you're very rich.
No, I mean, I guess this will be, but I'll pivot because I actually was in the unique position because I did work before grad school. I had savings. Like, you know, I was an entry-level government employee, so I wasn't like in tech or anything, but you know, I had savings coming into grad school, which put me in a better position than many people. And I got into a funded program. But I will say that having worked before, I was much more aware of the fact that I was like, yeah, I know how much it costs. So I wasn't coming directly out of school. I know how much it costs to have an apartment, have food, and like take care of my cats and like, you know, that kind of thing. And so I knew going into grad school really accurately that I was going to need a certain amount of money to live. And so like coming from a job, like a perspective where you already have job and bills and stuff like that, and then going into grad school gives you that foresight a little bit more. And then of course I had to make the adjustment because I was moving from Houston, which is super low cost of living relatively, to Santa Barbara, which is one of the most expensive places ever. So you have to do that math too. But I do think that one of the benefits of working beforehand is you get a sense of what it costs to be a person and not just a student. And because I think that being a graduate student is much more like being a person than, not to depersonalize college students, but your needs just change a little bit, right? As you get a little older.
That's very fair. You know, living is expensive.
Totally.
Just, you know, food, meds, rent, cars, depending on if you need car.
Occasionally getting like a bath bomb to just hang out, like get a massage, because as you know, as we get older, we don't bounce back quite as easily as we used to. You know, you gotta, things change. You get a little older, you have needs.
So like, what was that transition like? Because I can imagine, I'm not saying you were rich or anything, but I can imagine it was quite a difference, even just financially. But you can talk about other aspects that are not financial if you want to.
No, I mean, I'm happy to get dig into the finances. I like being real about this stuff. And I will be honest. So one thing that was really hard for me, and I'd caution anyone who is coming from a position of having a higher pay to grad school, is that the first year I spent way too much money. Because I was used to living on a higher budget and I didn't fully adjust in that first year. And after the first year, I was like well over what my stipend allowed or what my stipend gave me. And I dipped a lot into my savings and I was like, huh. And so then I had to rework my budget based on the new reality that I found myself in. But it was really hard because I'd gotten to the point where, like I said, I wasn't like exceptionally wealthy, but I could easily like order something off Amazon if I wanted it, or like, you know, go pick up some new books without really scouring the used section. Like these are tactics that you use in undergrad and when you have like less funds. And I just had to reshift my expectations of that. And I readjusted in the following years because I knew I had to, like, I wasn't going to be able to sustain, you know, again, like my comfortable middle-class way of living on my grad school stipend. Right. So I think that that's really important to note, is that it's important to go in with a budget that is adjusted to your new circumstance. And, be covetous of the money that you do have if you have managed to save before going to grad school, because it's just much better to have a little something in the bank for those like seasons of scarcity, right? So if you have a summer where you aren't funded, or if you, you know, something happens to your fellowship, and, or, you know, we all deal with the bureaucracy of the university and sometimes payments are late and like all these things happen. So having that a little bit of savings that you have from a real world job, or real quote unquote real job, like that will be make your grad school experience much less stressful in those moments of scarcity.
I think that's great advice, coming from someone who's also living on a grad school stipend and in a high cost area.
Totally.
It'd be very nice to have, but I get the caution, because when you have the money, sometimes it's very easy to spend it.
Yeah, it is. You have to put it somewhere. You have to put it somewhere where it's not super, super easy to access, but it's still liquid. So you can still have it if you need it. But it's not necessarily like just straight up in your checking account, right?
Hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess what other types of transitions, I guess, caught you by surprise when you were coming into grad school? Was there sort of that you're a student again, kind of? Was that sort of an...
I'll tell another, this is another funny kind of transition story, before we'll get into the nitty gritty of it. But so for example, I was, let's see, how old was I when I came back to grad school? I would have been 27 when I came back to grad school. And that's not a long time from when you graduate college at 22, but I was just much tired. Like, I used to go out all weekend in college and still maintain 5 classes. And I would go to the gym and, like, I don't know, I just had somehow an unlimited like pool of energy, and I was never tired, and I could go and go and go. And then, so I get to grad school and I'm expecting that same swell of energy where you can just do like go to class all day and then come home and do all the homework and still go out. And like that energy just wasn't really there as much, that sort of young adult, just
the youth.
Yeah, the youth energy, that youth in power. And I wasn't old or anything, and I wasn't an older, like, I might be considered a non-traditional student, like, by some accounts, but 27 is still pretty average with respect to people going to grad school. And so I wasn't an older grad student by any means. I have a lot of close friends, particularly in my department, who are in their 40s and 50s, but I can tell you that it is a strain, because it's and then there's this a lot of pressure to work all the time, right? But actually a transition that was made really easy, which I'll actually recommend to anyone going to grad school, and I think working in a real job actually serves, is I treated the first few years of grad school when we were in classes and having homework and stuff like that as a 9-to-5 job. Like, I just did, you know, I used to work 10-hour shift at the ME office, and it was a combination of going out to scenes and writing reports. I did the same thing as a grad student. I'd wake up and I'd do my reading and writing. I'd go to class, do my reading and writing. And I just did 9-to-5. And I really tried to honor that evening time so I could watch my shows, or, you know, catch up with friends, or do things like go to the gym, stuff like that. So, I mean, I think that that really helped me put things in perspective a little bit more, because when you go from being an undergrad student to a grad student, you just kind of, you keep ripping, right? You keep ripping in the way that you did in undergrad, and there's no breaks, and student is your job. But, like, you know, I you know, I work hard to cultivate hobbies and cultivate friendships and relationships, and I want to respect those boundaries. And as my PhD has progressed and you move past the stages of classes, so the first couple of years, you're heavily more into coursework. If you're doing a master's degree, it's going to be primarily coursework in the US, for example. Sometimes there'll be research component as well. Now I'm in the research component, and it's a little hard. The lines are a little bit more blurred, and especially with all the stay-at-home stuff we've been doing the last 2 years, right? So lines are even more blurred, but I still try to keep that notion of the fact that you can work set hours and still have that time off and still have that protected time of weekends, of evenings and stuff like that. And I think that by going like that transition of like, I knew like as soon as I started and I saw that, you know, some people that were straight out of undergrad were just jamming all the time. I had gotten into this really nice routine with my work where it was like I had days off and I had weekends off, or I, you know, we kind of worked a wonky schedule in the office, but like I designated days off. When I was off work, I was off work. Like I did not worry about it. And I tried to carry that over into grad school as well. And it was tougher because there's so much pressure to be on all the time in grad school and be working all the time. But I just knew that I heavily, heavily preferred the latter. Like I very much preferred having my protected time. And it was wonderful when I worked at the ME's office, because if I wasn't where the dead bodies were, I didn't have to work, right? So it was really easy to remove myself. In grad school, it's harder to do that. The work is always there, but you still have to work. So I did have to work to create those boundaries, basically. But I think that that's something really valuable, that when you're going into grad school, and I think honestly, again, like I think it serves you to have worked in the workforce, because if you're a student and you go straight into being a student, it's easy to think that that's all there is. And that's that way which burnout lies, right? So I think that actually working in another kind of job gives you that perspective in some ways. And so that transition was a little bit easier. So I think those are the two transitions that I think about most that were challenging. I think the only other thing was maybe like being a little bit more my own boss. So being more proactive. So in the job that I had, and in a lot of jobs, you're responding to input, right? So like if you work in a coffee shop, you are at the coffee shop making people's coffee as they ask, right? And maybe like putting out fires where needed. In my job, I was at the office for 10 hours and I would, you know, respond to calls and I'd do reports and I would just respond to stuff as is. And that was all directed under a supervisor, right? And I had somebody telling me like, this is what we need to do now. And this is what we need to do now. And a lot of times, particularly in the humanities graduate programs, they aren't, your advisor isn't going to be your supervisor. They are going to be somebody that's there for guidance and occasionally they'll help you with timeline stuff. And there could be different levels of engagement. I also recommend having that conversation with a potential advisor, because if you need a lot of oversight, you want to be pretty selective, because my advisor and I talk a lot about levels of supervision, because sometimes I'm doing fine, you know, and my mental health always fluctuates, right? This is a mental health conversation as well. So there's times when I can fly solo and I'm super okay at managing my own stuff. And then there's other times where I really need my advisor to push me and I need to tell her, like, I need to give you weekly updates, put it on your calendar if I haven't updated you this week to check in, because I need to tell you like what I'm doing this week. And so making that transition from having a supervisor telling me what to do all the time, or sort of being accountable at work when you're at work only, and then making your own schedule and like having to really like negotiate that supervisorial role, was certainly another kind of transition. And I think that I really thrive on things like structure. I put a lot of structures in place, one of them being the arbitrary workday. So that really helps me. Having like task managers and to-do lists helped, because that's like a form of accountability. And then having that external accountability when I need it, and particularly in those difficult mental health periods, of my advisor saying, you said you were going to give me this and this and this, and sort of in a very non-judgmental, like we're just having a conversation about what you, the expectations you set for yourself and now what you're delivering on. So I think all of these things were transitions, but I think that there's good, whether you're coming from a job or going into grad school straight from undergrad, to have that conversation with your advisor as well.
Absolutely. I think that's so important. And it's something that is sometimes overlooked, And that is setting expectations. And I know I'm going to mention Liesl for a second because she is the current president of PhD Balance, and she specifically works on this site. Her research is on this. She looks at the grad student supervisor relationship.
So, all right, we're going to link below Liesl's forthcoming PhD dissertation.
Yeah. But she has put on the website a supervisor agreement, supervisor-supervisee agreement that you can use to have that conversation about expectations in a structured way if you don't want to have it in an unstructured way, or you find it hard to bring up. You can bring it up where you literally go, we are going to write down what I'm going to do this semester. This is what I'm expected to do. This is what you as a supervisor are expected to do. And that is something that you can do. You can do it for a semester. You can do it for a month. You can do it for a year. And it can be helpful if that is something maybe that you're a conversation you find difficult to have.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I'm really privileged in the sense that my advisor is just super approachable and she's super down to earth. And it's one of the many reasons that I wanted her to be my advisor. And so, yeah, having that tool is probably like super valuable again, because those conversations aren't always easy. And you can always, and I'm sure that Liesl probably has tons of information about this, but you can always look beyond your immediate supervisor as well. Like in the humanities, like I said, we have an entire dissertation committee. And even if somebody isn't the chair of your dissertation committee, that doesn't mean you can't lean on them for support in other ways. For example, if they're like a more like, you know, for example, one of the people on my dissertation committee is like, my advisor is not huge on teaching. She is not like a huge, like, she's very upfront about this. She's like, I prefer the research. And I'm like, cool. But there's one of the people on my dissertation committee is really big into pedagogy. It's like his primary focus almost. And so he's the one I turn to for those kinds of questions and those kinds of feedback. So again, sort of using the people in your circle, even in the sense of like making a schedule for yourself and accountability and stuff like that, you can look beyond your primary advisor.
Absolutely. Mentorship comes from so many different places and it can help you. And I know classing your supervisor as a mentor depends on the person. So yeah, they may not be a mentor. They can just be a supervisor.
Totally. Totally.
So I guess coming back to our topic, what I know you've been peppering in tips anyway, but do you have any other tips for people going back to grad school that they maybe want to hear?
Yeah, no, I do have some. And I'd say the biggest one is probably do not consider any experience that you have as not important to your work. Even if you took years off to do something like work in retail, which you don't, maybe isn't directly related to your dissertation topic, that is still experience that's extremely valuable. You would be surprised at how, for example, you may be surprised at how many academics like are not good with people. Like they don't have a lot of interpersonal skills, and maybe that's something your job cultivated. And I think that coming in with confidence that you have life experience, even if that isn't academic experience, is really important. I just think that that's probably the most important tip, is just don't undervalue the experiences that you have in the quote unquote real world, because they'll really serve you. And an extension of that is also don't be afraid to use that experience directly to inform your research. I think too often we get a little bit disconnected in academia of the way the world works. So if even if your area of work was tangential to your dissertation, I mean, you know, you might have more information about like how people behave in those environments, and like, just don't be afraid to think about your previous experience as informing your research. You don't have to start from the ground up, and not everything has to be like siloed in the ivory tower, right? So we have the reason we exist in the world is the reason we make research is for it to be applicable in the world, I think. And I guess other tips would be to treat the grad school process much like you treated the job search process. You're in a position of power if you currently have a job, in the sense that there's no urgency for you to get in and go to grad school. So if you're still in the position where you currently hold a job, you can be selective, because grad school will be there for you, even if it's an additional couple of years, and you'll still be in your job and you're still making money. And if you're in the position where you're unemployed, the gap that you've taken between undergrad and grad school, and you're returning to grad school and you're unemployed, it's still grad school isn't like the way to become like employed necessarily. Like, you want to be just be selective and be your own advocate in these positions. Cause even if it feels like, well, I have to go to grad school, else I won't have anything else to do, then I just think just be really honest with yourself and what your intentions are and how you might approach it, because grad school is hard, and you don't want to be coming from a position of like, this is my only option to go into grad school. Cause I would argue that you want to really like explore the different things that you can do. And so, yeah. So if you're coming from a position where you have a job, remember that you have options, and you have the option to stay in your job and apply to grad school next cycle. You have the option to wait for that advisor who's on sabbatical to come back and be your advisor. So you have some flexibility there as well, and I'd use that to your advantage.
Awesome. So I guess before we finish up, because we've been talking for quite a while, is there anything else you want to mention, bring in? Where can people find you if they want to ask questions?
Yeah, no, you can find me. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram, both at CApplewhiteX. And so you can DM me on either of those places. I'm on LinkedIn. It's just Courtney Applewhite on LinkedIn. And so you're welcome to reach out to me there. Linda, we're going to launch this cool new series. So you'll be able to find me via PhD Balance, because we're going to launch a new series for Grad Chat. So stay tuned for that. And I'm excited to start getting folks to interview for that.
Yes, we will be launching it around the time this is coming out. So stay tuned to our socials for more information.
Yeah. And if you're on our PhD Balance Discord server, you can direct message me on there. I'm Courtney A on that server. I'm often on it because I just like to be, I'm of the generation of AIM. And so I still kind of crave that like instant message contact that we had with AIM. So I'm always on Discord. So if you need something, message me on there too.
That is great. Yes. So if you're not on the PhD Balance Discord, you can find it in the bios of any of our links of our social media, and also on our website. You can say join our Discord. This has been Grad Chat by PhD Balance. Episodes are now posted simultaneously on our podcast and YouTube channel, Saturdays at 3 p.m. Eastern. For more information about Grad Chat or PhD Balance, check out phdbalance.com or follow us on social media at phd_balance. Thank you so much for watching. Until next time, bye, and take care of yourself.